Man, that guy is a pro.
Nice try, JB.
You guys.
Oh, that was perfect.
Is this Baltric Brown? I mean, it's not Baltric. You guys are screwing with me again. And you cannot change. You cannot, like, even trust any name that starts with a B in this list.
Grizz. I say Grizz. Don't you guys changing it. I tell you, he sounds so professional. Welcome to episode 88 of the Plastic Posse podcast, brought to you by Tankcraft. I'm here today with four of my good friends, Scott, Jensen, JB, Doug, and myself. TJ is actually at Old Dominion right now, having a great time in another great model show. So we'll catch up with him on the next episode. So how's everyone doing? What have you guys been working on? Let's start off with Jensen.
Okay, so yeah, I'm good. I have been trying to, a lot of workshop stuff. So I have actually been doing some modeling. I know, shocking. So yeah, done a bit of work on the mini art milk truck. That is typical mini art, so a few thousand pieces. But I've noticed with every new release, the molding's getting nicer and nicer. So each part, like the cleanup's becoming like kind of minimal. That was the thing with mini art, like in the olden days, it's like you'd have a million pieces and every single one would need mold line cleanups. But no, this milk truck so far, really impressed. Cleanly molded, like it is crisp. The plastic's like nice and firm, so it's not like warped or anything. It's just, it's really nice to work with. But I'm also planning another few projects with the guys. That's all to come in the future. But I'm trying to do some stuff in the workshop. So like above my, I'm trying to find less excuse to like be distracted because I have terrible focus. So in my workshop, where my computer is, like in front of my screen and my monitor, I want to find the excuse to say, well, I'm at the computer, so I can't model. So I'm going to get some light in and put it, because I've got a floating shelf above my monitor. I'm going to get some LED battens, put them there so I can work whilst at the computer as well. Like, so it's like, okay, now you've no excuse. You can see what you're doing. Get on with some stuff. So they're on the way. And then, yeah, so yeah, it's nice to actually get some glue to plastic. It feels weird. I've never done this hobby before. It's fun. I think I might do it more often.
Is that the three-wheeled milk truck you're building?
It is, yeah. And what I like about mini art is as soon as they release one thing, they'll release a billion different versions of it.
Yeah, that's just a fun little kit. I've got one sitting, the mover one with the trailer, the hutch in the back.
Yes.
So I can't wait to get to that. JB, how about you?
Everything's absolutely fantastic on my side. I've actually gotten a chance to hit the bench a decent amount. Work's still keeping me away, but I did receive the big box of Tigers, like most people on the internet. You know, TJ's meme with Homer sitting at the bar and everybody has a Attack on Tiger box. That's definitely been Facebook the last 48 to 72 hours. But I'll tell you what, it's been a really fun kit. I've spent two nights on it, probably collectively, I bet five hours, maybe six tops. And it's really nice. I got probably 70% of it done, and I would highly recommend it. You know, there are a bunch of Tigers out there, but, you know, these are cheap, these are available, and they're super nice. So I think TACOM did a really good job. I believe that this is the TACOM that we all want to see. If that makes sense, you know, some of the kits we've built from them, you know, lack pedigree, but this one so far, minor things here and there, and I'll document them and share, but I'm talking purely from a buildability standpoint, not accuracy. I'm not a Tiger, you know, expertin, but you know, from what I've seen, from what I've read on the internet, if you can believe what's on the internet to some degree, it's actually a fairly good kit. And the Zimmerit pattern looks absolutely fantastic on it. That's the main driver for me buying these. Price and value, but also just the Zimmerit. Dragons kits, you know, if you can find them at a show, maybe they'll get them for like 20, 30 bucks if you're lucky, but typically they're 40. But these are brand new, 40 bucks, turn barrel, photo etch, and the Zimmerit is really, really nice on them. So super happy about that. Looking forward to getting this one built up. I'll be doing 503rd sphere, Schwerpanzer Abteilung, which is like a heavy tank battalion. And I will be doing it flipped upside down. So this will be from a vehicle during Operation Goodwood, where they were carpet bombed essentially in the Normandy sector. And this one flipped over. So I'm going to do this late model. And then I'm actually going to do a mid as one going through Rome, I've decided, because it has a motorcycle in the back and just a unique vehicle. It's got some travel features on it. So enough about me and Tigers. I'll turn the mic back over to you.
The Zimmer, it does look really good, and you can't beat the price on those things. I mean, I don't care what any, it's, if you find a Dragon Tiger for $40, let me know, because that's really good too. That's a great deal. They look great. They have everything you need for them. All right, let's head over to Doug. How you been doing, Doug?
Well, I'm okay. a lot of you know I just had surgery, so a lot of my last 2 weeks has been spent in just trying not to move. So much that that I hurt myself. But before surgery, I started that little TACOM Hetzer. It's the early production Hetzer, and it's been a lot of fun. I have some issues with it in construction. It was fine. There were just too many things where, you know, hey, this little tiny part has to go on this little spot, and there's nothing to align it with. You're just going to get lucky. It, when you put it on, and it's kind of silly that way, but for the most part, I'm very happy with the kit. I've got it into paint and I'm working on that. The other thing I worked on was not a model, and I know a lot of you probably think it's silly, but I worked on my first ever Lego kit.
Ah, cool.
Well, my son, after I came home from the hospital, gave me the Atreides Ornithopter from Dune. And it's got over 1,300 parts, and the engineering in it is kind of fantastic. It's 31-inch wingspan, 22-inch long body, solid. It has levers to open and close the wings, and a little knob you can turn to drop the landing gear and the ramp, and you can even push a little piece on the back that flaps the wings. It's pretty impressive, considering it's just Legos. But it got me out of the bed and on my feet for days. And so I was really happy to have that. It was all I could really do at the time. I don't think I could have worked on an actual kit. I didn't want to have to glue anything or sand anything. I was pushed to my limit already. So, but that was a lot of fun. And I'm looking forward to getting back down and cleaning up my model room a little bit and getting more work done on that Hetzer.
That's great. You showed that build, and that's that Lego kit. Don't worry about it. I do Legos too. Don't worry about it. I'm sure there's more of us out there. Really excited to see it. All right, Scott, how about you?
Well, I guess I would say my last couple of weeks have been spent doing field research. I'm recording with you guys from Plano, Texas in a motel room. But yeah, we went up to Seattle, and we'll talk more about that later. But got to see Bill Huffman's shop, which was incredibly inspiring. Also got to go to some amazing museums and see some great models. No tigers here. I'm excited to get home and get back to my bench. I picked up a Ben-Hur trailer from the Skyway shop up there in Seattle. So that's cool. Another little mini art piece. And then I also got a box from Andy's Hobby Headquarters that had some additional farm implements for my tractor vignette that I'm working on. So I'm excited to kind of get back to that. Also excited to kind of get started on a World of Tanks Object 704 build that I have planned. I found out I have a little more time on the Bell X1. So I'll keep working on that, but get some more armor up on the bench and bump another aircraft over for a few minutes. But anyway, that's what I've been doing.
Oh, that's great, Scott. And, you know, safe travels. And it was so fun seeing you and JB last week in Seattle, seeing everybody, actually. It was just a great time. I did miss a couple of the tours, which I'm bummed about. But, you know, we did have a great show. We had a great time, and it was super fun. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. Myself, actually, I've been a little sick. Caught a little something in Seattle. I think I'm not used to the cold weather, being from Southern California. And then when I came home, it started raining. So I got a little sick. So not much work done. I did start working on a dinosaur that Doug gave me quite a while ago, which is a bust. That's been really fun, actually. It's from Dinos and Dogs. It's a 3D print. It's fantastic. I actually went on there last night and printed off another one. I'm having so much fun with it. I did not get my tigers yet. I think I'm on the later end of the bill, but I'm looking forward to it. Just I can't wait to get those. But other than that, it's been a real kind of quiet week for me. A lot of home time, a lot of sleeping. So it's that time of the year, I think, where everybody's getting a little ill sometimes. So so that's going to kind of lead us into our first discussion question. TJ and Scott, they were lucky enough to go see Bill Huffman's workspace. And so we kind of came up with an idea about a question is, how does your work environment influence your modeling on a daily basis or on a, whatever kind of basis that you're working on? I don't mind going first on this one because I don't have a big area. When I did live in Arizona, I had a huge room, which I was able to move around in a lot easier than what I have now. And I was more productive to a point. And I'll say, let me explain that. I was building more because I had more space to put stuff. But by having more space, I had more mess. It makes sense to anybody. I ended up having stuff all over the place and getting myself lost in subject. When I moved home, I kind of decided that I didn't want my own kind of room for modeling. I just wanted a small area to help me focus my skills a little bit, I guess, on what I'm working on. So for me, and I know this is not everybody, but for me, I like a smaller area and I like a clean area. I'm very, very clean about my stuff. If you look at my desk right now, you wouldn't say I was clean, but I like to clean up after every time I build. I stop, I clean up, I put stuff away. Part of the process, I think, I don't know where it probably comes from, the military, you know, and I have everything boxed up and out of the way. So that kind of environment for me is the best. I think if I have a bigger space, I get a little bit more messy, but God knows I wouldn't turn it down now because I have a lot more stuff going on. But overall, that's what I think. Let's go over to Scott and see what he thinks.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, you know, we'll talk more. We have some content coming, but anybody that knows Bill Huffman and has seen any of our posts or pictures from his space, it's really, really inspiring. It's an environment that I think can really encourage you to be both productive and also creative, which I think are kind of definitely different things. I don't have a lot of room compared to Bill. He has a lot of room. And I think that, Grant, you're right. More room means you do maybe have to do more cleaning and everything. But I think it also gives you more space to organize and put, you know, more tool chests or paint racks or things like that. So I would love to have, you know, more space. I tend to like a very clean and organized build space, but because I don't have a lot of space, it gets dirty and cluttered very, very quickly. So it would be great. But, you know, Bill's space in particular, he, besides being a modeler, is quite a craftsman. You know, he likes to have a lot of tools and design tools and build cabinets and build shelves. And he takes a lot of pride in that. And I think it's sort of like a self-sustaining cycle, if that makes any sense. And then the other thing that I think that Bill's space really inspired me, Jensen mentioned earlier, kind of removing distractions or removing excuses mm-hmm. from being productive. And I think, you know, Bill's space really, really does that. I mean, when he goes in there, he has, you know, a microwave, a refrigerator, a computer, you know, he kind of has everything that he needs where he can go in there, whether it's doing research or, you know, grabbing a snack or whatever. I mean, he could literally go in there and probably be in there 12, 14 hours and be, you know, relatively comfortable and again, be creative and productive while he's doing that. And so that was really inspiring to see. You know, I model in the basement, so, you know, I just have to run upstairs or whatever, but I really liked Bill's space and has me kind of kicking around some ideas of maybe how I can improve at least the efficiency of the space that I do have.
Yeah, what I like about Bill's area too is it's like he can go basically from cradle to grave in that room. He can start with the model, build the model, make the base, make the frame for the base, and like I say, go from cradle to grave with one thing right there, and he doesn't have to go anywhere. And that's really impressive for me. I'm sure most of us don't have that ability where we can, you know, we have the wood shop material right there. We have everything we need. And I think that's very impressive. And that helps with his motivation and his build, because in my opinion, if he's at one spot and he's having trouble, he goes, well, I can go work on the base right over here, and I can, you know, I could see what I was working on before, and then I can get ideas for that better. And, or I can go cut wood or plane wood or whatever I need to do to get this base whatever I wanted. I think that's very, that's a really good idea, really good positive of having that kind of environment, is you've got that cradle to grave kind of.
Yeah, Grant, John, one thing that I really, as I was walking around the shop, besides the creativity and just Bill, you know, the shop just screams Bill. But one thing that kept running through my head over and over was, you know, I had an auto shop teacher that would always talk about every tool has its place. Use it, put it back. And, you know, whether it was a line of planers or a line of sanding tools or files, Bill has really taken the time to put everything where it goes. And you can just tell when he needs something, he knows exactly where to go. You know, he mentioned to us that it doesn't really get dirty. He really keeps it clean. And I think that's the way he's kind of designed the space. You know, John, what do you think of that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, Bill's spot is unbelievable. Like you said, the space has a flow. It has a, dare I say, it has emotion. It has love. And man, it's an incredible, it's I'm just super jealous. And it's not only inside, but it's outside as well. You know, you walk outside there and you're next to a mountain. You can hear the river. You have evergreens that are growing from, you know, stumps that were harvested over 100 years ago. It's an environment that looks like Jurassic Park, for crying out loud. And as I think, you know, going back to the root of the question and around environment and my environment, you can see the evolution of my work through the space in which I work. You know, when I hearken back to undergrad, gosh, nearly 20 years ago, building at a desk and being able to build single models, graduating, going and getting my own little, you know, spare bedroom in an apartment, you know, growing that not only, you know, in terms of models, but also your tools, your paints. And with that comes a progression in your modeling skill, I think. And then I almost regressed there and went back to grad school. And that's where JB Closet Modeler came from, because I literally was building in a closet in a one bedroom apartment. But now I'm very fortunate in a sense where I have my own space, and you can definitely tell, like right before we started recording, my space is a mess right now. And it's really influencing my work, because it just slows you down, because you're like moving around things. You got to, you know, sort through sprues that you're like, I'll just pile them up, and then crap all over the desk. Maybe there's another project mixed in, and that just kind of bogs down your production. And with that, creativity, I feel. So when the space is clear, when it's open, when it's, dare I say, free, the blinds are open, you can get some vitamin D, I'm much more productive, much more creative, and just having a more, you know, a better time for that matter. And I find that that's the most important thing. And I've gone through this phase where I've reorganized things, you know, building a rack for the wall, buying a paintbrush holder, doing all these little things that I think, you know, incrementally improve, because sometimes you just get tired of the way the space looks. You know, it drags you down. It's like, oh man, you know, it's just kind of, you know what you're getting into. It's like, I got my airbrushes over here. They're kind of stacked up. I got, again, crap everywhere in some cases. So I think, if at least for me, after going to Bill's, like full circle Bill's back to my place, it's understanding what, I think there's another update needed here. And it's an update to, you know, declutterize the space, make it more open, make it more freeing. And with that, I think comes, as I mentioned, productivity, creativity, and finishing too. I think that's a big thing, where you get going on a project, you stall a little bit, and then you look at it and you're like, I don't even want to touch this anymore. And you just grab it all, throw it in a box, and you start with a clean slate. And I need to avoid that. You know, go again, heart of the question, environment 100%, at least for me, influences my work.
And, you know, I do agree. I mean, you see stuff like, I look at my area and you look at Bill's area, and you can't help but be jealous. You see it and you think about, okay, well, I can do this in my area. That's a good start. You know, that's what you need. That's what we all need. So that's definitely a positive.
We talk a lot about areas, and, you know, we know Bill's amazing space. I think it's also important to acknowledge there's some modelers that we know that their environment doesn't matter. Exactly. And a good example is Martin Drayton, you know, working from a hotel room and pulling that off. You know, I think I've seen Jeremy Moore do it as well. Some of our pilot friends and those in the airline industry, that's almost a common occurrence with them. And I think for those individuals, they're, you know, that environmental constraint, restraint, limitation doesn't affect their work. And I admire that a lot. And I think it's important just to call that out, because you don't have to have a big room. You don't have to have a building for that matter. I mean, look at David Hobbs. He has his own outbuilding as well. It's incredible. Those are like the dream scenarios. But there's also worlds where you can work off of literally a kitchen table and create works of art. So I know we're talking about the space and how it influences our productivity, but that's not the case for everybody. And I just want to make sure that as a podcast, we're acknowledging those people as well, that, hey, I've done it a bunch of times, but you know, give a person a 6x6 space and see what they create. Except Nuke Man Mike. I mean, he's just a victim of his own circumstance. He's just like, you know what? I'm just going to jack up my whole bench. Let me throw a hand grenade in here and constrain myself purposefully. But no, I, again, the heart of the question I agree with, also acknowledging there's a world that it doesn't matter to them. So,
oh yeah, definitely. Brian Krieger has worked off his kitchen table forever. Yeah. Yeah. Just got his own room. I mean, his work.
Great example.
Unbelievable work, you know, and it's the individual instead of the Doug. So what do you think?
I work in a pretty big space. I've got a nice room in my basement that I built specifically to work on my models. And then I just proceeded to cover that space with all kinds of modeling stuff. I've got space to work anytime I want to. And that's great. I actually should have space that three people could be in here working anytime they wanted to. But I generally have a project piled in one spot and then another piled in another spot and then a little space cleared that I can actually work on if I needed to. I like my space. It doesn't inspire me to build more because it is disorganized. I'm not one of those, like Scott was mentioning, that has a place for every tool. I mean, I kind of do, but I never put them back where they belong. That's not how my mind works. When I'm done, I set it down and I focus on what the next step would be. And I kind of get lost. And that slows me down because now I've got to figure out where I put that tool or that paint color. I mean, I have a rack for my paints and I usually am good about putting those back, but occasionally I don't. I also don't have outside of my model room at the moment a display area for models. So a lot of them are sitting on a shelf right above my bench, which is below my rack for paints, which means occasionally I bomb my finished kits with paint bottles I knock off the shelf. So I've got to figure something out there. I am working on the last room of my basement. When that's done, there will be displays out in the rec area of the basement. But it does slow me down. Man, I would love to have it a little better organized. Scott has a little space. He's got that, what is it, a 6-foot table, Scott? And yet you've got everything like perfectly laid out in front of you. I've been down there and it's just nice. And I've watched you work. And when you're done, you set that paintbrush or that knife or that scriber goes right back where it was. And it's not how my mind works. My mind's a mess anyway. So, you know, when you translate that into my model room, it's a mess.
Yeah. For me, if I don't do that, then I end up going back to Jensen's comment, I make excuses. You know, I go down to the bench and if it's a disaster, you know, I just turn around and go back upstairs. It's just easier to go watch some football or, you know, a war show or something, you know, rather than deal with it. So, yeah, I try to keep it clean and organized. But, you know, like anybody else, the next, you know, you start and then all of a sudden you've got a 3-inch by 3-inch square of your bench is where you're working. Everything else is taken up. So,
yeah. So kind of goes into one of the issues I have too much space. So it gets filled with crap. Yeah. Like what Grant said, the more room I have, the more room I have to fill with stuff I don't need to fill it with. Yep. I'd like to think that my surroundings and my workshop influence my work. They don't, because it, as far as I'm concerned, to me personally, I have everything I need. It's like kind of like the perfect workroom. It's indoors where it's warm. It's got good lighting, everything I need in here. It's like organized. It's got cupboards, big workbench, lots of space. Got my computer, photograph area, 3D printing area, everything I could need. And yet my production is still very, very low. So don't get me wrong. I absolutely love having it. I would never get rid of the space I've got. And does it feel good to be in here? Yes, it feels amazing. But it sadly doesn't. It's not that maybe I take it for granted. Other people might look at my workshop and be like, oh my God, I wish I could have that. So I do think I take it for granted and don't use it to its potential. Because, like I say, anything you could need as a modeler is in here. I just, that's a kind of a me issue with my incredible lack of focus. But yeah, it's just one of those. I wish my surroundings kind of not inspired me more, but like had more of an effect on the amount of work I did. But it's weird because I absolutely love going to other people's workshops and seeing other people's workspaces. That I actually find more inspiring than being in my own. But yeah, it's just one of those things. Everyone works different. And for me, because I spend like probably 16 hours a day every single day in here, it's kind of, I just live in here. That's the thing.
Yeah, maybe. So it is an inspiring productivity just because you're in there so much, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's actually something I kind of wanted to, you know, maybe get some tips from you guys. You know, one thing that I did that made a big difference for me was I just went to Lowe's or Home Depot and bought a piece of cabinet grade plywood and made a rack for all my airbrush paint. And I think I need to do the same thing for my, you know, my brush paint, because I find bottles of paint are always in the way, you know, and they really kind of close things down. But I don't know, maybe go around the room and you know, what are some tips, and I'd love to hear from the listeners on this topic as well, as you know, what are some tips that you guys have to make your space better or more efficient that you could share with everybody, especially Nuke Man, to keep the benches clear and to be both creative and productive. But I don't know, Grant, maybe what are some, maybe a tip that you've done that has improved your space for you?
I would say the biggest thing that improved my space for me was I bought a roll away mechanics tool chest, the 3 or 4 foot tall ones. It's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 drawers on it. And the drawers are, they get bigger as they go down. I put all my paints, all my tools, everything in there, so I know exactly where they're at. So I don't have stuff sitting off the side of my desk or in a box or in another drawer or underneath something. So I could just, and it sits right next to my desk. So all I have to do is lean over, pull open a drawer, and there's the stuff. And it's all labeled. That's probably the best thing I've ever done to help me with that. And one more thing besides that is that AK 3 Gen does this, but I'll take paint and put it on the top of the paint bottles. He has a little, AK Gen 3 has a little nipple or whatever you want to call it, indentation where you pour the paint in so you know what color it is. I just put, if I don't have that, I just paint the top of it a little bit, even if it's got the color on it. So that helps me paint faster. So I know exactly where the paints are because I don't have them out. But that's the best thing I've ever done, tool chest and the paint stuff. How about you, JB?
Yeah, it's all around organization. So one of the things, the listeners can't see it, but I went out and created a rack for paints. And I have, let's see, I have 6 shelves and they're collectively probably 5 feet across and it's completely full. And that's not even a third of my paint. So it's interesting. I really need to do a purge at the bench. One example, relative to the story, because it affects my workspace and the environment, I've really gotten obsessed, I'll say, with AK third gen paints. I have found that they are, from a brush painting perspective, you know, when you suck at something for so long and you're like, what are these things that can help me? Practice, obviously, but let's look at the tools and paints. And my Lord, if you can get a nice Kalinske Sable and some good acrylic paint, ooh, it changes the game. Just like airbrushing, to be honest. So long story short, I got a lot of paint stuff and a lot of rack space. I think my next factory reset, call it, is going to be around looking at my paints critically and be like, do I really need these? Some of them I haven't used for years.
Right.
And especially on the acrylic side, I'll be honest, I have Humbrols from 30, 40 years ago that were my dad's. I do not see myself giving those up. I have Gunzi stuff, not going to give those up. But when I look at some of the acrylic paints I have, and especially with bringing third gen in, it's like, do I really need 2 of these paints? Do I really need to keep this one that I'm not a huge fan of brush painting? And I do struggle sometimes with airbrushing. So long story short, I think not only organizing and creating that, you know, space that's, again, well organized, I guess you could say, and easily defined stuff, it's clearing out the old. And I think as modelers, we can all agree that we have trouble clearing out the old. It's with our model kits, with our build stuff. Like, there's these emotional attachments. And I get it in some cases. There are some builds that I will never give away. There are some paints, like my dad's Humbrol collection, that I will never give away. Like, those, not only they still work, but they have an emotional attachment to me. But as I look around the bench and I'm staring at some paints that I haven't used, I'm like, I don't think I'm going to use these, especially when I'm refilling the color palette with AK third gen. And it's like, okay, let's just pull the Band-Aid off.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the last time Martin was in my room here, he was looking, I'm like, you use Vallejo Air? He's like, yeah, I use Vallejo. Here's a dozen bottles. Take them. I'm not going to use them. Just take them. And that's some of the other stuff too, where I got repeats, three-peats. And if it's not a color I routinely use, just give it away. I don't care anymore. Or go to the Scale Model Graveyard, which is a fantastic source, and clean out the bench. Not only from a stash perspective, but tools as well. So again, I find myself talking a lot longer than probably you want, Grant, but you know, it's a combination of organizing what you got and then clearing out what you don't need.
That's great. That's very important. Doug, what about you? What do you think is important?
Well, organization, of course, we're talking about that. Places to put your things that you're using, all your tools. I do have places for tools not as well organized as it should be, and maybe not as the nicest space. It's basically I've got an old box top, like a skinny box with a foam lining that I set my tools on. But it's the paint organization that's made the biggest deal for me. That shelf I built for I've got airbrush paints over on one side, and then I've got my brush paints on the other and all my weathering stuff on that one as well. And that's just made every difference, because now I know where to look for what I need. When I need a paint, I go right to it. It's organized well enough. I mean, I don't have the Tamiya color XF numbers memorized, but all I have to do is glance up there and I can recognize by their caps, you know, which color range I'm looking at, and I can go find the color I need. And it's fast and it's easy. So that was the biggest thing I've ever done.
That's good.
Organize those paints.
Yeah. I think I think everybody's about paints on this. I think that's our biggest space holder.
Yeah, well, we have, most of us have hundreds of bottles of paints.
Oh, yeah.
So if you just had them sitting in a box somewhere or piled over here, you know, just kind of shoved into a corner, it would be hard to find everything. But if you can spread them out and have easy access and they're easily viewable, then you can find them quick.
100% correct. What about you, Jensen?
One of the things when I hijacked this room was I made the decision straight away is I wanted a humongous paint shelf. And whenever I post a picture of this room, first thing people say is, how much paint do you need? Because I wanted to have one shelf that has every paint I have. Unfortunately, that doesn't work anymore because I bought a lot of paint since, so now it just doesn't fit. But I wanted one that could hold my entire range of Mr. Hobby aqueous paints, my entire range of AK real color, a lot of my MRPs, some of my pigments, my washes, weather effects. Basically, if I have it, I wanted it in one place, and I was on the wall. I didn't want stuff in drawers. I like to be able to literally just look up and see what I need rather than go looking for it. Yeah, that was the first thing. And luckily, I made lots of shelves, lots of different sizes. So now, like JB said, buying a lot of the third gens, there's a shelf that's big enough to fit them. Yeah, it was definitely a decision I made as this room was getting built. I was like, I want one place for all my paint. Anything that overflows, or I've got duplicates or stuff that just never going to use, but I refuse to bin because that's something we do as well. That can go in a drawer. So there's lots of drawers, lots of storage. I also made sure that my air compressor was away in a cupboard rather than on the carpet and the floor set. I live in socks. I don't like wearing shoes. And I didn't want to be kicking my compressor all the time when I'm in my spray booth. So that's away inside a drawer. I just wanted everything to look clean and away. And like, what's on my bench is what's on my bench.
Socks and snuggies, man.
We all had some great ideas. We all have some, you know, interesting things, but I'd like to hear what the listeners think. So, you know, go onto the Facebook page, drop us a line of what your work area, how you like to work. What is your best idea you came up with to give yourself a little bit more space here and there? And I also want to hear about how big everybody's paint collection is, because I swear to God, I think we all have a paint collection of about 1,000 bottles. I know we do.
All right, let's take a short break for a recap of shows that we've recently been to. I'm going to have a conversation with JB and TJ, so here we go. All right.
right. Welcome in, everybody. I am here with JB and TJ, and we are going to get caught up on some recent model shows and related activities. These guys, let's just start out with the Atlanta show. JB, kind of walk us through how that all kind of came together and what you guys did, and TJ, jump in whenever.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thanks, Scott, for that introduction. The Atlanta Military Figure Society hosted their annual show on February 9th to 11th, and it was the first time I'd ever attended. And TJ was lucky enough to go last year and kind of put the bug in my ear, Zach, Aaron, and Jackson's as well. And what turned out to be an absolutely fantastic weekend. And it started even before the show. I was lucky enough to fly in Thursday night. Aaron picked me up at the airport and we stayed near Atlanta. And then we headed south the following day to Fort Moore, which is the home of the U.S. Army's Armor and Cavalry Collection, an exquisite place. This is even before the show, mind you. So we got there as soon as it opened, and then TJ, Jackson, and Grizz showed up. And TJ, I know you made the trek with Jackson to Grizz's, is that correct?
Yeah, so we drove down, and how we ended up doing it was Jackson met me at my house after I got off work on Thursday, and we got out of there. We took off from Percival, heading south, probably close to 5, a little bit later than I wanted. Then we drove to Kingsport, Tennessee, which is where his grandparents live, who are amazing people. I mean, just your prototypical grandparents, you know, plying you with food and beverages as soon as you step in the house, and won't let you leave without taking food with you at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning the next morning. Oh, here, take some candy. Kids love candy, which is true. Kids do love candy, and I love candy. So yeah, we managed to get down to his grandparents' house Thursday night at around, I want to say it was like 11:30 at night. So it's about a 5.5 hour, maybe a little less drive from my house. We stopped at Waffle House, crushed some waffles and some delicious food. I love Waffle House. So, I mean, it's a greasy spoon food, but man, it hits the spot when you're driving. And yeah, so I think we didn't get to bed till probably close to midnight. And we were up at 4 o'clock. Well, I was up at 3:45 the next morning, so we could take off by like 4:15 to drive to Zach's house, who's about 35 minutes away in Jonesboro, Tennessee. We picked him up, and then we headed 6.5 hours down to get to Fort Moore. And I think we got there around 11, because we'd stopped again at Waffle House, the three of us, and crushed some breakfast food, and I drank a ton of coffee. And yeah. It was a hell of a drive. I was exhausted.
Yeah, I tell you, in terms of reunions, I don't think there's any place cooler than Fort Moore and the Restoration Bays, essentially on base. So for those that don't know, Fort Moore, former Fort Benning, as I mentioned, is the home of the U.S. Army's Armor and Cavalry Collection. Essentially, that means all of the armored vehicles from Fort Knox, Aberdeen, and then other, I think, you know, bits and pieces from collections across the country as well, have made their way down to, honestly, a state-of-the-art facility. They have one large building. I don't know the square footage. I bet it's over 100,000 square feet. It's got, I think, over 450 vehicles in it, stemming all the way from pre-World War I to modern day. And it's nothing short of amazing. And when Aaron and I arrived, it was the first time he'd ever been there. And he walks through the door and he had the experience that I had last December. And it's pure overwhelming. And I know TJ saw that as well, and I'll ask for his input in a moment. But you know, we did that, and then we went over to the restoration bays, and what is there is a former Bradley facility. I think it was like training and maintenance. So there's these large bays, and we're, you know, Aaron and I are BSing with David Hobbs and BJ DeBecker at the entrance, and they're like, "What do you want to see?" And we're like, "Oh, shit, we'll see anything." Well, okay, this lovely gentleman John took us over. And we're just walking through, and he's like, "Yeah, you know, some of these, I just don't know what's behind the door. So we'll just have to check here and there." And Aaron looks at me. He's like, why don't we just open all the doors? Why don't we just peer into all of them?" So the first door we opened was all the way at the end of the facility near the entrance. And you open this door and the light shines. I swear to God, it's like out of a movie. And it illuminates this giant Yog Tiger right in front of us. And it's like, holy shit. That's a Yog Tiger right here in this garage. And the guy's like, "Yeah, let me, you know, open up the front garage door." And it it's just, you know, I'm struggling with words because it's just such a surreal experience seeing this vehicle. And it's totally beat up, missing one side of tracks, rusted. It's got the Aberdeen paint scheme on it. So it was, again, I'm speechless because it was friggin' awesome. And I'd highly recommend everybody to go there. But, you know, we went through all those bays and then we met up with TJ Jackson and Grizz in front of the Stug 3, which was really cool reunion. And then they opened up the back door and they're like, oh, yeah, let's go check out the back lot. And oh, man, that was just as cool as the main museum. I mean, TJ, talk us through what was back there, which was exquisite.
Oh, man, that had all sorts of stuff that, you know, the first thing we saw when we walked out was the L70, which was pretty cool. It was falling apart, but I mean, it's just cool. Right. So I'll back a little bit. When we got there before, I think even before we found you, Hobbs is like, there's something you guys need to see. There's a Sherman here you need to see. I'm like, okay. And we had the same experience. He's like going from door to door and he's like, I don't remember which one it is. I'm like, oh yeah, I hate it when I like forget where I put my Sherman. And then we went to find that because he wanted to take us to see that because it's like an entirely unique vehicle. It was the Calliope test bed. It has stuff that no other Sherman has in the world. It's 100% unique. It was really cool. It took some pictures. The rocket launcher piece is like sitting in front of it, so you can look at it. It has all the fittings and stuff welded to the side. Had a lot of interesting features anyways as a Sherman. I took a few pictures of some weird weld patterns that I've never seen before, but that was cool. So yeah, then we went out to the back lot and, you know, the first thing you see is an L70. And then there's I think it was a Panzer IV right next to it. Then there's an M4A4 Sherman, which was cool, which I was glad to see because I had a question about something I did on one that I did. I was vindicated, so I did it right. I was happy. And then, yeah, you just walk around all that stuff and then it's just stuff everywhere,
just more vehicles
and most of them are in pretty poor shape. There's an M4A1, I think it's HVSS Sherman sitting all the way in the back. If anyone knows Ken Childress's work, he modeled a vehicle, not exactly that one, but based on that one that's sitting there. It's like kind of rusted out. He did like, I think 2 years ago. So that was pretty cool to see the inspiration to that. And he was telling me about, he was there. So he was telling me about it. Yeah, it was pretty cool. They had some stuff that I've never even seen before or even knew existed. Some of those things. And it's right by, I guess it's like the wash station from where they would bring the vehicles in. They'd drive them into the, you know, little pit and it, you know, that was usually full of water and it'd wash them off so they could take them back in.
Yeah, that area I thought was just as cool as the building of the pristine vehicles. As TJ mentioned, L70 in the back, mind you, they have two of them, which is pretty wild. There was a couple Panzer IIIs back there. The Panther, which was the last Panther, there's the famous Munich Panther that's green and the green and brown one is sitting there without tracks, kind of sacrificed to keep the Panther II running, I believe. But just an exquisite area. David Hobbs mentioned, you know, during the summer, we don't open this place up because of snakes. I'm like, okay, that's cool. And then as TJ mentioned, there's a Mark IV, which was the hydrostatic drive, only one in existence. It's in the back. We like to say these are rusting away and look not that great, but to be honest, they're in the best place they can be. The museum is slowly restoring these vehicles, bringing them indoors. As TJ and I talked about, there's multiple bays at this old Bradley building, probably 30 or 40, maybe even more. It's like opening King Tut's tomb every door. And they have them stationed in there, whether it's Stug, Nashorn, SDKF-Z7, some even modern stuff. There was a Stuart in there. They had a Ural T-72, I believe, I saw as well with Aaron. So just an overall super nice facility. Major shout out to David Hobbs again and Rob Kogan, who is the museum curator. You know, I'd like to give him a lot of credit because he's got modeling in his blood, but he's also very passionate about sharing the collection. And in another world, they could close those doors and never let anyone from the public in. But they have, they've committed to sharing the history of, you know, the U.S. Army Corps and then also its adversaries and what we've brought back from conflict. So this was a special tour that was associated with the AMP show that we'll get to. But routinely, at least once a quarter, they host an open house. And some of those open houses are paired with live fire exercises. And so the public does have a chance to go on base and see that collection. But bottom line, it was amazing. And then we hopped in the car and headed north to the show. And I'll turn it over to TJ because did you judge Friday night? Because I did not.
No, well, I'm gonna circle back real quick because there's a couple things that I wanted to talk about because this is the first time I was there. So me personally, this is the first time I've seen a tiger, a panther, a tiger too, a yag panther, a yag tiger, literally all that stuff. I've never seen any of that before in real life. The tiger one was, I believe, captured in Tunisia and brought back here. It was cut open so that you could see it. That kind of sucks, but also it's cool because that's what it was there for. It was there to learn and train our crews. The thing that I really liked, I actually ended up getting a poster of it because I made a donation to the museum. I have a British Mark V Star heavy tank, combat use, the only one in existence anywhere in the world, saw combat with the American Expeditionary Force. We have a combat record of it. Two men of the crew were killed in action. Two men earned Distinguished Service Crosses for the same action. It's amazing seeing at this point, 107-year-old tank that saw combat, you know, in Europe, and it's here and standing in front of me. It's been restored. It was just cool. And then seeing all the American heavies that, you know, are prototype tanks that we built, the T-29 and all that, T-34 and all that stuff. People don't really think about America when they think about heavy tanks in World War II, but these were huge. They never saw combat, but if they had, they dwarf anything else. I mean, they're staggering the size of them, really. I think it was the T-34. I was standing, I'm 6 feet tall, I have a decent wingspan. I'm standing on my tippy toes. I couldn't even touch the barrel in its level. Like, that's how big this vehicle is. It was huge.
They make the Tiger II look small.
Oh,
because
yeah.
They're right across from it. And it's a staggering how big they are.
And the Tiger II is massive. That is a huge piece of metal. And the other really cool thing is they had a Renault FT turret off a combat used vehicle. Just the turret. It was just pretty neat. Just say, oh, here's a relic. You know, we don't have the rest of the vehicle, but this turret was in combat. But yes, going back, driving back to the over 2 hours to get back to North Atlanta where the show was. No, I did not judge Friday night. I was in no shape to judge. I was exhausted. Of course,
we took advantage of their hospitality suite, though, I feel.
Yeah. Oh, so we the way the show works is the figures are judged. Actually, I think they start judging amps Friday night, too. So the amp setup is the typical amp setup. They have a ramrod and the judging station like in the back. And the figure show is you just check in, you put your stuff on the table and that's it. And then starting, I want to say at 9, they start late to start to judge, but it doesn't take that long. I did it last year as a trainee. I didn't think they needed anyone this year. I think they had enough judges, which was fine because it's a fun experience. I really enjoy it, but going to B-dubs and eating some wings and drinking beer was a worthy alternative to judging. So that was fun. And then, yeah, like you said, we went back and hit the hospitality suite. And for those that aren't familiar with how like figure shows work in the United States, more than one day figure shows, obviously, like my local show doesn't have this because it's one day, but these multi-day shows are punctuated by the hospitality suite. And if you are involved in the show or you know people involved in the show, which is we do and we were, so you are invited to the hospitality suite where there are plenty of snacks and adult beverages of every variety and as much as you would like. And I think obviously Zach does not abide, but the rest of us took full advantage of that with some of our friends, like Mark Sprayberry was there and Dave Hobbs, of course. And we had a good time.
Yeah, it was certainly awesome. I think what was unique I found, the figure show, at least this one, I felt the timing when we think about traditional model shows, it's like, oh, the event starts Saturday and Sunday, or it was just interesting because they went late into the night. We showed up and I think the vendor room was open till like 7 or 8 at night. And then you could enter models in, I think, until 9 p.m. So it was kind of a late show, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, I want to say the vendor room was open even later than that. I think it was open till like 8 or 9. It was open late.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It was definitely still open when we went to dinner, and we had a late dinner because we had a late lunch. We ate lunch at like 3:30 in the afternoon. Yeah. I think we went to dinner at 8:30 and the vendor room was definitely still open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I spent money. Yeah, we went to lunch with Jackson, who's never had a calzone before.
Didn't know how to eat it. Was confused by the knife and the fork.
What is this thing? I don't. Yeah. So anyway, we go back to the show. We're in the vendor room, enter our stuff. Had a good time at the hospitality suite. And like TJ said, anyone who's anyone in the figure community is there, and they're all extremely open arms. You know, I had a great time talking to Bob Bethea. I talked to him for like each day for a long time. Super nice guy. And we're talking, these folks are people we admire all the time. But I what I found the most interesting. So, you know, we go to sleep Friday night, wake up, go down to the figure show. The competition area, or I should say the exhibition area, is really different than what we know of in traditional scale modeling. It's not about categories. It's not about individual pieces. It's about the individual. And I thought it was really neat where you walk around, and yes, I know that there are collections and they present them that way, but this was unique where they actually had their names. If they've achieved Grandmaster, they had their engraved plate there and they displayed their work. I just thought it was a really professional environment, and the folks there were extremely open to talking about their work. And, you know, I just thought it was really great. And Amps was around the side, but TJ, any takeaways from the exhibition hall?
So they did a couple new things this year. One, they had amazing lighting. They got a bunch of LED light stands like you would see like on a job site and put them in the corners and I think along the wall and pointed them up and just flooded that thing with daylight LEDs. That was my biggest complaint last year, especially when I was judging. It was very hard to see some stuff. And granted, I'm a youngish man, but even then I have to wear readers when I paint because I had LASIK. So my eyes, that was the drawback. That was the thing you sacrifice. And it's starting to catch up with me. It was difficult last year because the lighting was not the best. But this year, the lighting was absolutely fantastic. I was very impressed with that. It was a great idea. The room is not huge. That's how they're able to get away with it. I mean, the other thing they did this year is they did not display your name on your entry sheet. So every year previous, and it's this way with most figure shows, your name is there. So that way you know who does what. And of course, the people everyone knows, you see their stuff on the internet, like you know who they are. So yeah, like obviously Jim Rice doesn't even need to put his little Grandmaster plaque next to it. You know Jim Rice's work. You know, Mark Sprayberry, I've known Mark for a couple of years. I know Mark's work. I don't need to see his name next to it. I don't know why they did that. No one really explained it to me. It is what it is. They wanted to try it. So who knows if they're actually going to go back to it next year. But yeah, it was it's very well done. And the way it's set up is all the figures are in tables. The room's like a rectangle and you enter at the short side. And the tables are going perpendicular down into the room. And all the figures and stuff broken down by the couple of categories they have are in the center. And then Amps is the tables like going wrapping around the room, not all the way, but a fair amount. In full disclosure, it is not a large show, especially on the Amp side. I don't remember the numbers, but it's not like crazy amounts. It's good work and the guys there are great, but yeah, it's not like a huge massive show. And now there's the figure show, but it's a multi-day show, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was certainly a lot of fun. And I'm sure it was similar to Scott's experience at MFCA with, you know, the open system. And I just really enjoyed that the two disparate clubs came together. I will say an area of opportunity is equalizing the entry fee. I paid 30 at the figure side, but the Amps was 25. So, you know, if you go next year, maybe you'll get a $5 discount over at the Amp side. But I think it's important to note, regardless, if you enter both, you pay once. So one entry fee will get you through the door and get you to see the competition or the exhibition area and the vendors as well.
Now, I did judge on Amps on Saturday. The team of four was me, Zach, Jackson, and Aaron. The four of us judged an hour, maybe a little over an hour, to help clear the backlog. We were one of the last teams. So there was two other teams working with us and we were trying to get everything through. I love judging amp style. It's fun. Usually if I can, I'll volunteer to judge for Amps because it's easy. If you have a good team, That's the best part. You hand pick your team. It's not like at an IPMS show where you just can get stuck with a bunch of people you don't know at AMPS. That can happen at AMPS too if you sign up to do that way. But if, you know, I think, I can't remember. I think Hobbs told Jackson that they needed a team. So he went and rounded us up and we walked in as a team, which is cool because then you know who you work with. You get a good flow. Everyone, you know, looks at, you know, knows what to look at. Yeah, I enjoy it. It's always fun.
Yeah, for sure. I did not judge. I'm not allowed to be left unattended, so I didn't judge that show. But it was a great time regardless. So, you know, Atlanta, no, in all honesty, it was actually good not to judge. It was fun. I took advantage of the time and went and photographed a lot of stuff in the exhibition hall. I'm certainly thankful for everybody that did judge at the show, because not easy work, a lot of quality stuff on the table, and especially on the figure side as well. In terms of awards, they awarded everything on the AMP side Saturday evening, and then Sunday, everything was awarded in the morning. So that was a little interesting. I didn't know what to expect Sunday, where I thought the show would be kind of still ripping and roaring, but it's almost like it's teardown, and the thing that caps it off is the morning presentation. So I actually kind of like that, because people aren't like rushing to leave Saturday night, and you just kind of have a leisurely evening, catch up with folks, sleep in. Go down, pack up your stuff, hit the awards ceremony, and then you're on your merry way. So if anything, I might fly out a little bit earlier next year, but overall, fantastic experience.
Yeah, I'd recommend anyone that has the opportunity to go. It's fun. The people there are great. The models there are great. The award ceremonies are cool. The vendors need a little bit of work, and I think the organizers know that. Luckily, Sabo Miniatures is there every year, so...
They were a good anchor.
I spend a fair amount of money with them.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of stash sellers. Scale 75 was there too, which was also good. Because they have great stuff. Squadron was there, but he only had scratch and dent stuff, which was fine. I bought a little bit from him too, because the price, you couldn't walk away from some of these prices.
$10 for an Abramax. It was missing a little photo etch fret. Yeah. Unbelievable. That's free.
I bought a $60 out of production Wolverine figure from X-Men for $10. It retailed for $60 when it was brand new.
I got Archer rivets for $2 a set.
Yeah, so did I, because you made me buy some.
I'm like, these are $2, buy them, don't worry about it. We can talk about this later. Aaron Cook, that bastard, he bought both Archer weld sets for $2 a piece. He's so greedy, he ain't even going to use one, let alone even cut the bag open on it. So
he had to buy those because he doesn't know how to sculpt them, so I don't blame him.
That's true. That's true. You know, gobbles to him. but that was, it was a fun event, and it was really great to see Aaron. You know, we razz him, and it was really good to see him, especially with Jackson and Grizz. It was good to get a piece of the Treadheads together, our kind of little group. So it was wonderful to see everybody. And despite being a couple days, they went super fast. But again, it was just great to see everybody and their work. So.
The other thing we didn't mention at Fort Moore is also Site B for Hobbs's stash.
Mm.
So anyone that knows Dave Hobbs, he has a legendary stash. I've never seen the main one. You have, JB.
Yeah, I have. I'm still recovering from it. I mean, I just have, you know, plastic envy, if that's a thing. I mean, holy cow.
He literally has everything and multiples of everything.
Yes.
So he took us down to his Site B, where he has just boxes. He doesn't even know what's in the boxes. He's like, hey, tell me what's in these boxes. I'm like, okay. So, you know, we're going through them, and I found a Daswork /TACOM Panther A late, which is a kit I've been looking for. It's out of, you know, you can't get it anywhere. It's out of stock everywhere. And I'm like, can I have this? He's like, yeah, it's fine. I'm like, what do you want for it? He's like, oh, we'll figure it out later. So, yeah. So I went home with that, which was pretty cool. And poor Jackson, he wants a Sergeant York so bad. And every time he's with Hobbs, he pulled out a box. There's three in there. He's like, Hobbs, can I take one of these? Yeah, no, I'm running low on those. Like, yeah, okay. Running low with all the three Sergeant Yorks that you're never going to build.
At this site, mind you, there's probably three more at his home base.
Though in Hobbs's defense, that Sergeant York will probably show up at Jackson's house in like 5 months. Is usually what he does. He did the same thing, I think, last year with the Fire Scout. He wanted, I think it was even before it was out.
Yeah.
On Fire Scout. And he's like, can I have this? He's like, nope. He's like, yeah, but you got like a whole bunch of it. He's like, yeah, sorry. And then like 3 months later, it shows up at his house. after they were like, yeah, I'm like, he's like, oh, I don't want any more.
Classic Hobbs. So for our listeners, you know, we talk a lot about David Hobbs. He is one of the technical advisors for TACOM. So a lot of this stuff in Asuka. Yeah. So he is a Sherman expertin, and also a lot of just, you know, again, if TACOM is releasing an armored vehicle, he's probably touched it in some way, shape or form. And that vehicle probably exists at Fort Moore as well in some capacity, whether it's, you know, directly itself or a variant of it to get some technical research. And I know he also has quite the database around Shermans and just a wealth of knowledge. So, you know, we're doxing him. We're saying that, you know, David Hobbs is the Sherman guy. If you have a question around Shermans, he's the guy. You know, he's training the young Padawan Jackson and Grizz, but really, he's as good as it gets here. There's a few others, but major shout out to him.
Yeah, he is. He is Mr. Sherman. He knows pretty much everything. Though his favorite trick is to know the answer to the question that you asked him, but not give it to you and wait for you to figure it out yourself. His other favorite trick is to give you the answer even after you couldn't figure it out, and you move past when you need that answer and you're done. And he's like, oh, yeah, it's right here. But yeah, I've been the victim of that a few times, which I don't mind. But Dave's an awesome guy. And kind of going back to that, they just got a Lima-produced M4A175 from Germany. It was at a collection in Germany somewhere. Like, just showed up, like, I think a couple weeks ago or a month ago. Still sitting outside, still more or less strapped down because it's not in the best shape. So that was pretty cool. I got to climb all over that. Took a ton of pictures. So I'm kind of taking a page from Ken Childers. I'm going to build that one in the condition that it's in now, because it's pretty neat features. I know one side has like three or four different style of road wheels, which is always fun. I love that. And the other side is they all match. So yeah. Anyways, Dave Hobbs is awesome. He knows everything about Shermans. So yeah, it's always good to spend time with him.
Yeah, he doesn't like Scott Gentry though.
No, seriously.
Oh man. Yeah, but bottom line, I think the Atlanta experience, highly recommended for all of those on the East Coast. I'll be honest, it's worth the trip for the museum alone and getting that access. I've gone during an open house. It's fun. There's, you know, maybe a couple hundred people during that day throughout it. This was literally 20 to 30 people. And in the afternoon, it was me, TJ, Jackson, Grizz, and Aaron walking through the building. I think we were alone, or if there was one or two staff members there. And it's quite surreal when you have the run of the place that literally any piece of armor in the, you know, ever used in conflict, a variant of it is there. It's pretty staggering. So highly recommended. Check out the show. Plan to go early. Definitely want to hit the Friday open house, and then the show Saturday, Sunday. And you can leave Sunday morning and get back at a decent hour if you're on the East Coast, or fly out west like I did, because Atlanta is not that far away, the airport.
Did you guys enter in anything in the show?
Yeah. Of course. I mean, I'm the type of guy, if I go to a show, I'm probably going to enter something. And I had a piece in historical painters on the figure side, a piece in historical painters, and, well, pieces in historical painters. Because, like, I think JB mentioned, you enter as a display. Each, you know, you'll list everything you have, but it's all on one sheet of paper, and you put that sheet of paper with your stuff. I got little risers to put my stuff in on, because that's a thing. I forgot to get some felt, but luckily Rod Curtis, who's one of the grandmasters down there, amazing guy, and a fantastic Napoleonics painter, amongst other things, but known for his Napoleonics. Super nice guy. He's who I tagged along with last year when I judged. He hooked me up with a piece of felt to put on my risers, you know, so it looks real nice. And then I had, I think, two or three pieces in fantasy painters. And then I entered a piece in the amp side. And then, unbeknownst to our friend Jensen, I brought his L70 with me and entered it in his name. So yeah, it was pretty fun.
How'd the pieces do?
I think I earned silvers in both categories in on the figure side, which I was happy with. And I think I got a silver or a bronze for the Churchill that I brought, which I think I got a silver, which checks out. I don't like that build. And it got broken in two places. So it's done. I might strip it for parts, honestly, because it's a conversion and it's got stuff that I can take out off of it. And then Jensen got a bronze for his L70, which I read the feedback forms and I don't disagreed with that one because it's pretty damn good. That's why I have it, because I got to keep it when he was here over the summer. So yeah, I don't know what was up with that. I think he got robbed a little bit. That's just one man's opinion. So he was still stoked, you know, that I, you know, in one of our group chats is holding a picture of a medal. I'm like, oh, look at you, you silly bitch. You were here and you didn't even know it.
Yeah, I think he was pretty fired up about it. That was cool that you did that for him. JB, what about you?
Yeah, I took six pieces. So I entered three in the amp side, the FJ, the SDKS 253, and the Sergeant York. Lucky to take gold for all of them. And then I entered one facade in the Atlantis on the figure show side, I should say. That took gold. And then I entered my two little Warhammer Terminator dudes, and they took the blue one took a silver. So I'm super stoked, to really pleased. And I'll be honest, I thought the coolest medal was the Atlanta figure show side. Don't get me wrong, the Amps one was cool. It wasn't the standard Amps one that you would get at the national show that has the Abrams on it. This was their own that was unique. I think it had, was it a Sherman or an M3 on it, TJ? It was one of the two.
I don't remember. And now that I think about it, I don't know what I did with mine. Oh, it's in my backpack still. Yeah, I forgot. Right. I need to pull that out. But yeah, I don't remember. They do have cool medals. I just don't remember what's on them.
Yeah. And then on the Atlanta figure show side, it is, you know, Amps gave you a medal and a plastic, you know, case with it. The figure show side, it's a nice medal. And then it comes with a wood box that you can flip open and orient it up, angled. And I just thought it was a really classy award. Very simple. Again, they're generic. They're all the same, gold, silver, bronze in terms of style, but it was a little step up with the wooden box. So overall, 10 out of 10 there. And major shout out to Aaron. He took a gold with his T-34, and then he took a silver with his Mac. Jackson took all golds. No one likes him, but he paid them off, so that's why he took gold. And then Grizz, I believe, did really well as well. I think he took golds and silvers. He crushed it. So overall, again, I think we're very lucky to have some quality modelers in our small circle of friends. So it was great. And then just to note, you know, we ran into a bunch of other posse listeners there. We've mentioned a few names, but everybody at the show is extremely gracious, and we're just super thankful for everybody that said hi.
Yeah. And props to Jesse Naughton for A, going to lunch with us, which was awesome, and B, winning best in show on the amp side with his little Stuart. And I think he had a couple figures.
Yeah. He crushed it.
Yeah. Did very well.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was great without you there. No, Scott, you got to go next year. These are your people. Like you said, MFCA, a lot of people were asking about you, but it's, you know, similar vibes. You would love it. And we were super sad you weren't there.
Yeah, sounds like a great show, similar to what I'm hoping to put together in Salt Lake with my group, Hybrid Amps, and, you know, open judging figure show. So anyway, well, the next weekend after that, we had a show in Seattle, the Northwest Scale Modelers Model Mania show, which is at the Museum of Flight, which is in Renton, Washington. And then we also did a whole bunch of other things, which, you know, I sometimes think that the model show is great. It's awesome. But some of these other things you get to do are amazing as well. We got to go to Bill Huffman's workshop, and his place is unbelievable. It's almost like, you know, something out of Lord of the Rings, the setting where he lives. And then we got to go to the Flying Heritage Combat and Armor Museum, Air and Armor Museum in Everett, which was fantastic. And we also got a kind of a special tour. I'll let JB tell you the story of that. But anyway, and then the show was great. We got to have, you know, a whole bunch of friends meet up with us, and just a great time. So JB, maybe a couple of highlights from you on the Seattle show.
Yeah, I was going to tell you to pump the brakes there, because there's a lot of things you're glossing over. But, you know, as Scott mentioned, it was another fantastic weekend. Kind of the same theme for me. I flew in Thursday morning, flew out Sunday afternoon, but essentially every day was nonstop. Scott mentioned coming in to Bill's place. It's a surreal experience, and it's really great. We don't want to spoil too much. We posted some pictures online, took a lot of video content. So this is our chance to break through in YouTube world. We're hoping to put together kind of a little short video of the space. Scott did a great job interviewing Bill and walking through some of the unique builds that he's done, some of the areas in his shop that really tell a story. And we're very excited to share that at a future date. you know, going on to Friday, that's where we headed north up to Everett. And, you know, with us was Jim Bates. He was the show chairman. We had Cameron Corliss as well, as Scott was there, as you know, Josh Buck, and then Grant actually flew in later that day. But for the morning, we went up to Flying Heritage, and it's a museum that I've always wanted to see. It's unfortunate, you know, COVID happened and then Paul Allen died, and the museum essentially went dormant for a few years. And there was a lot of conjecture and a lot of rumors, a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of angst around, is the museum ever going to open again? And if it does, is it going to stay in Seattle? Well, fortunately, at least for the time being, it's open and in Seattle. And we went, and it's an unbelievable collection. I like to use the word surreal during this episode because it was another surreal experience. All of their aircraft, well, 90% of them fly. We're talking Mosquito, D-13, which they've never flown, the Focke-Wulf, but it could. They have a Focke-Wulf. I think it's an A5.
Yeah, a 190 A5.
Yeah. They have an E-Model 109, P-40, P-51, Spit, Hurricane. Don't paint the Hurricane like that one. You got to take the spinner off. It's a trigger point for Jim Bates. So just if you go there, shoot him a message. Tell him you love their Hurricane and how they've painted it. But in all seriousness, he has the real story behind that Canadian Hurricane. And it's really cool. It was almost having a docent there right there with you. So shout out to Jim Bates. Thanks for that little bit. Also there, ME-262, absolutely pristine, restored with the Jumo engines. It's a staggering price tag on that restoration, but it's certainly amazing to see it in the flesh. And then they had a Stuka in progress as well. That's on the aircraft side, and that's only a few of them. In addition to that, they have a crap ton of armor, and most of the armor runs. They had a G-13, a Hetzer that was absolutely exquisite. They had a Syrian Panzer IV and a bunch of American armor. So bottom line, you've seen the pictures online. If you haven't, check out our Facebook page. We posted some there. We have a bunch more. Most of it will probably find its way into the Scale Prospector. Going to do a little feature on the G-13 in the next issue. But yeah, bottom line, unbelievable place. And as Scott mentioned, when we were leaving, we went over to, I think it's Legend Flyers is the name of the organization. And yep. Shout out to Steve Baker. He was there and our docent. He walks up and he's like, yeah, let me just go up and walk and knock on the door. So he goes up, knocks on the door. This, you know, gentleman opens up, and Steve, you know, does his nice Southwest captain, you know, schmoozing, gets us inside. And then there's a damn Zero that's nearly ready to go fly sitting there. And we spent probably hour and a half in that hangar.
Yeah, at least.
At least. So, you know, the gentleman who met us, who let us in, was one of the shop workers. And come to find out, like, he knows more about the Zero probably than anybody else when it comes to manufacturing it. And he did a lot of work on the 262 as well. But we ended up meeting the owner and his son, who happens to be a modeler. And they were the nicest two folks in the world. It was an amazing experience. We walked all around. They let us climb on the wing to look inside the cockpit. They had this really awesome, I mean, I feel like he was 50 to 75 pound bulldog running around the hangar. His name was Herman, super nice little guy. And they took us upstairs, and Scott, maybe talk us through what they discussed, you know, when we had the opportunity to speak with them.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, the owner of the shop, you know, when he was talking to us, he kind of walked us over to the wall and showed us the list of restored aircraft that they had done, you know, and we're talking about Messerschmitt 262s, a Messerschmitt 163 Comet, which actually was in the Flying Heritage Museum. And he started talking about the Zero they were working on, which was just about done. And I mean, this guy was, you know, talking about every single flying Zero in the world, and he could tell you where that Zero came from. And if it had, you know, the original Sakai engine, or if it had a Pratt Whitney in it, he knew literally everything about it. Oh, this one is a Russian copy. You know, that one's not legit, but this one is. It, you know, it was really, really amazing. But, you know, kind of showed us that after this Zero is done, he's going to start a project where he restores not one, but two of the interwar P-26 P-Shooter pursuit fighters, American. Really, really interesting. He's got the fuselages there, and I think there's only one or two of those in the world. None of them will be restored to the level that they had, but just on and on. I mean, these guys were amazing, and their love and passion and dedication to what they did, you know, it kind of reminds you of a modeler. Like, they literally know, you know, the provenance of every single piece, you know, and they let us take a look at the pieces of the Zero that had been originally recovered from Malaysia. And they were talking about how the original U.S. owner had acquired the Zero, and what he had done is he'd gone to the island and talked to the natives, and he ended up trading a Ford farm tractor for this Zero, and definitely got the better end of that deal. You know, we got to take a look at the pieces, and, you know, some of the aluminum used in the Zero is almost like construction paper. It was so thin. It was really, really just an amazing opportunity to kind of get, you know, behind the scenes of these restored, you know, Warbird classics.
Yeah, and special shout out to Bob Hammer. He's the owner of Legend Flyers. And then what was great, you know, we're talking to him, we're like, hey, yeah, you know, we're scale modelers. And he's like, oh, my son's a scale modeler. He's going to stop by in a little bit. And, you know, his son walks in, Dan, super nice guy. And we strike up a conversation. He was kind of the docent for us there and walked us around the shop. He's a scale modeler. We looked at his work online, talked through conversions and, you know, CH-53 he was working on, and showed us the scratched rotor hub. And gosh, what an amazing guy. And it's cool that he's a modeler. And it's even better when we're standing there and we're talking. He's like, oh, yeah, I spent time at PAX, was in the Navy. And we're like, do you know a guy named Whitey? And he's like, oh, yeah, I know Whitey. And it was just really cool. Small world. And, you know, he said, tell him Gunny says hi. So just an amazing community. And it just a lot of fun.
Yeah, really great experience. Like you said, friendly people, you know, and, you know, how often do you get to look into the cockpit of a brand new Zero, you know, hasn't even really taken out of the factory yet. So that was a great opportunity and really just amazing to see anybody who has that much passion and love for what they do, you know, and that we just got to see a lot of that. And the Pacific Northwest is just full of aircraft enthusiasts and craftsmen, you know, Bill, walking around his shop. You know, it not just his modeling, but his passion, his love for everything that he does, you know, and it's just amazing. So, yeah, it was a great, great experience.
Yeah. And then we went to the show, and the show, as Scott mentioned, was at the Seattle Museum of Flight right there at Payne Field, just a little bit south of Seattle, close to Renton, where we stayed. And again, an absolutely fantastic experience. Major shout out to the Northwest Scale Modelers and Jim Bates, Tim Too Tall. And just their club members there put on an amazing event, great displays, and it's a display only show. And they had over 2,000 models at the event. It's one of the largest draws for the museum every year, and they've been expanding every year. And this year was another, I got to give a great shout out to Josh Scott and his friend Ron. They were tenants of the Gundam display, and there's a large Gundam display there. I think they had over 250 models just in Gundams, which is pretty significant for a traditional model, I guess you could say, themed show in terms of aircraft, armor, cars, dioramas. But what's interesting is that show is growing in diversity. So you have Gundams growing. You have a gentleman there that builds stuff out of matchsticks and like coffee stirrers, all wood. And it's a model in my mind. And you had some paper models there. I thought I saw dioramas from Bill Huffman, which are integrated into furniture. You have workstations for people. So even if you show up and you want to build a model, this event gives you the opportunity to literally pull up a chair and sit under an SR-71 and build a model. Nowhere else on earth you can do that. And that's something you'll always remember because it's freaking cool. And everyone there is super nice. Lots of children. And I'll say they're extremely well behaved. You know, I think Josh might have had a heart attack once or twice when a kid was maybe reaching for his Gundam, but overall there were no casualties during this event. Everyone had a blast. And what was really cool is there were some seminars as well. Rick and I did a tandem one, and we did them on bases. I did one on concrete. He did one on Pacific Island, and it was just a fun kind of collaborative experience. And then we also hit Skyway, which is one of the last vestiges of amazing old school hobby shops. Scott, anything to add?
Yeah, you want to give a shout out to Matthew Burchett, who's the curator of the Museum of Flight. He's an incredible person, a great supporter of the Northwest Scale Modelers, and Jim and the crew, as you mentioned, for NWSM. You know, the show is just great. You know, you have over 2,200 models on display, and most of the public that I think that comes through aren't necessarily modelers, but it really brings the crowds in. You know, there's a line at the door all day long on Saturday and Sunday. Like John said, it's worth it just for the ambiance of where the model show takes place. Just a great event. I think the museum really enjoys it. I know the club really enjoys it. And, as modelers, we're just really, really fortunate. Rick and JB's seminar was a lot of fun. You know, they each had their own seminar. They decided to combine it. So what you really got was kind of a 2-hour presentation that kind of went back and forth. And the format really worked. I really enjoyed it. There was quite a few people that attended it, and it was great. You know, the community of modelers in Seattle is really terrific, thriving. There's a lot of, as John mentioned, a lot of different modelers using different mediums and modeling different subjects. It's just a great experience. It's something that's a highlight for us each year.
Yeah, 100%. And it extends both Saturday and Sunday. It goes to about 4 o'clock on Sunday, and then they start tearing down. And I'll just hit on Skyway one more time. It's right there in Renton, you know, maybe less than 10 minutes away from the venue, super close. Anything and everything can be found in there in terms of consumables. Email the owner is super nice, and their kit selection is amazing. They had a sale going on when we were there. I blame Steve Baker. He made me buy the Edward BF-109K. So that should that might be a March Madness bill, but overall, just an amazing experience. We went both days. Scott unfortunately left a little bit early on Sunday with Josh, but regardless, the time we spent together, just like Atlanta, although it felt short, it was just really great, and we have some everlasting memories from that event.
Yeah, John finally found one of those Mini Art Chevrolet pickup trucks with the dual tires front and rear, and I found a Ben Hur, a Mini Art Ben Hur tractor. Which I've been kind of looking for. So yeah, great selection, great shop.
Yep. Cute dogs too.
Awesome. Well, just again, another show that we look forward to every year, on the East Coast is one I haven't been to yet, but TJ, you guys went last week or this weekend actually to yesterday to the Old Dominion Open. So tell us a little bit about that show.
So if anyone isn't familiar with the Old Dominion Open, it's a Region 2 show held in Richmond every year. It's the first show of the quote-unquote season for IPMS shows. It's always at the end of February. The geeks like to call it a mini Nats, and it's pretty accurate. So this year there was 950 models on the table from 227 entrants, which is staggering. And it's a one-day show. It should probably be a 2-day regional show because they have the support to do it. I guess that, talking to Darren, there's other things they have to do if they make it a regional. They do an awards banquet, which boring. But I would like to see it go to a 2-day show. It's huge. I barely got to see half the stuff on the table. Honestly, I didn't have the time between talking to people and going out to lunch with people and just spending money. You can't look at everything. There's not enough hours of the day, in my opinion, but it's a fantastic show. The IPMS Richmond guys do an amazing job. And this is the third year in a row that I've been. It's one that I don't want to ever miss because it's great. And of course the geeks go. So it's always great to see those guys. I love seeing Darren and Whitey and Frill. And I even finally ran into Nemo. He was, felt like he was ducking me all day, but he was just running around doing all sorts of stuff. Then most of the guys in my AMP chapter made the trip down there as well. And then this year, Zach drove up Friday, which was his birthday, and stayed with Jackson. I picked him up Saturday morning and drove down there. So Jackson and I we drove down together last year. I met him there 2 years ago, which was cool. And now Zach got to experience in it. I believe Zach said he will make it up here every year because he got to hang out with Jackson. They spent time today. When I dropped him back off yesterday, they had a little cookout with some of their friends. So yeah, it's a fantastic show. The vendors are amazing. Insane prices for a lot of stuff. I bought a Dragon Sherman 3 M4A2, the Fisher Hall one. the better version of the one that Martin Kovac is working on right now. He's doing the earlier version of that kit, and it's a little more inaccurate. This is the most accurate version you can get of this particular tank in plastic. $25. Okay. Dragon Shermans aren't Asuka Shermans. No one's going to say that, but for $25, I'll take that all day long because you can make a good model out of it, especially if you need that variant, which I do. So, yeah, I bought a limited dual pack of I-16 Type 10 Russian fighter for in Spanish Civil War markings. $40 for a dual kit. You know, it's got two kits, 8 marking options, photo etch, all that stuff. Yeah. A guy was selling Machining Krieger stuff, old Nitto stuff for like $10 or $15, which you can't get that for that. He had some newer stuff for like $30, which is what that stuff should cost because that's what it costs in Japan. And Pat Brown cleaned him out. He bought a whole bunch of stuff from him. And he grabbed an old Nitto kit before I got there. He's got there before we did. But yeah, absolutely fantastic show. If you have the ability to make it to Richmond for that show, I highly, highly recommend it. There's a guy, he goes by the Instagram handle, Natto of Rice. He drove up from Birmingham, Alabama to go to the show. He ended up taking home the best Gundam, which was pretty cool. Him and I got a chance to catch up. We've been buddies on Instagram for a long time. He does amazing work. And kind of segue into that, IPMS Richmond has made it a point to reach out to the Gundam community and the sci-fi modeling community in general and encourage them to come to the show. And anyone that's been there will tell you that you'll see more Gundams there than you probably will at IPMS Nats. It's probably more Gundams than you're going to see outside of a Gundam focused show like the GBWC or even like Wonderfest in Kentucky. A staggering number of Gundams. They have their own separate Gundam category, which is great. That's awesome. And it's just good to see that an IPMS chapter has made an effort to reach out to these people when so many of the old guard don't want to do that. And these guys do, because, you know, we've mentioned it before, like, yeah, that's where the hobby is going. And it's not even necessarily young people, like the people, because it's men, you know, men and women that are building Gundams and in that community. They're not kids, right? They're adults. And it's kind of, I get a little annoyed when like, oh, well, this is what the kids are building Gundams. No, they're like 25, 30, mid 30s. Those are adults. Those aren't kids. I mean, I guess if you're 70, that's a kid. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, they're adults. And yeah, there are young people doing it too. But, you know, they've extended the olive branch to that community and they've been embraced. And it's awesome to see. And it's also funny because even the guy doing the announcements, he makes a joke about, you know, oh, he's like his favorite part because he's going to screw up all the pronunciations of all the, like the random Gundams. They all have weird ass names. Right. And like he doesn't care. The builders don't care. It's funny. And, you know, seeing them, they cheer for each other and congratulate each other. The community, that community is fantastic. You know, you don't see that in the scale modeling in general community as much. It's definitely there. But, you know, there's a lot of certain people that won't, you know, they won't congratulate you because they didn't win. My friend Jeff won best armor, and some of the people that were up for best armor, do you think they went and congratulated him? No, because they were butthurt that they didn't win best armor, and they're going to go home mad about it, which I think is hilarious. So yeah, fantastic show. Like I said, if anyone listening, if you're within driving distance or even flying distance to Richmond, go to the show. It's probably the best one-day show in the United States that I've ever been to, just in terms of people, scale, and quality of work. There's some damn good work on those tables.
And the geeks, they were there in force, like you mentioned. They probably did some recording, I assume, from the event, too, based on their setup, it looked like.
Yeah, so about that, they always have that setup and never record, except for this year. They made it a point to actually do recording, which is pretty cool, because that's what I think it was Whitey was telling me. He's like, yeah, he's like, we bring this every year and then we just never do anything. It's like, it just sits here and then everyone kind of wanders around. I'm like, well, good. I'm glad you guys are actually doing it now. So they talked to the Detail and Scale guys. I think it's Burt McKenzie and Rock. They, because they're one of the sponsors, they did a spot. Those guys are super cool. And then I think they did a little bit of man on the street type stuff and grabbed some people to talk to them. And I'm looking forward to listening to it. It should be really good. They have a nice mobile setup, so it always sounds pretty good. But yeah, they were, every time I walked past their table, they were busy doing something. I didn't really get a chance to actually talk to them until really towards the end of the show.
How'd they do on the models they entered?
Oh, as well as they always do. I mean, you just hear those names over and over again on every aircraft category. And of course, those lucky b****s, they only enter aircraft. So, they always stick around, you know, for the best ofs. But you know, in theory, you can leave because aircraft is always first. Well, juniors are first and then aircraft.
I never noticed that. Maybe that's a tie.
What's that?
Juniors and aircraft modelers. You know, so. There's
probably,
a common,
probably the same thing, right?
A common thread right there. I'm just saying.
it was a good show. Of course, Jackson did well. It was good to see he just finished a M4A2 Jungle Jim. It's a Marine Corps tank. I don't think it was on Iwo. I don't remember what island it was on. It's fairly well documented. There's quite a few pictures of it. That's the first time he was. I get to his house and Zach answers the door and I'm like, "Are you guys ready?" And he's like, Jackson's still downstairs. So I go downstairs, which is where his bench is, and he's painting it. He's putting enamel effects on it. And I'm like, hey, we got to go. We have to drive an hour and a half. Let's go. He's like, yeah, hold on. Let me finish this one part. It was legit off-gassing all the way there. Like, I know everyone makes that joke. This actually was. It was wet. The effects he was putting on, which I don't remember what he was doing, it was dust or dirt of some variety. It was literally still wet when he set it into his little container to walk out of the house. It was the first time he'd been out of the house. I think Zach took a picture of it on the table. It's the first time anyone say he hadn't even taken pictures of it yet. And it did well. It came in first in Allied armor, which he always does. So I don't even bring armor to that show anymore. There's no point because Jackson, I enter all the same categories as he does. He's just going to beat me every time. And he has every single year. I believe is also in contingent for best armor, which was pretty cool. It did not win best armor. No, it could have because it was damn good. And then Zach did well. He brought his little facade that he scratch built and sculpted the figure on. The pictures look fantastic. It's even better in person. It is amazing. And it's really small. And he put it in a little picture frame. I mean, it's like this, right? Like it's itty bitty. And it's amazing. I think he got a second place for that. I'm pretty sure he got it placed, and then I think he placed with some armor too. And then my buddy Pat Brown was there, who Scott knows. He placed with some of his armor as well. And then Jeff Feller, who is a member of our AMPS chapter, he's an AMPS Grandmaster. He, you know, rushed to finish a Churchill Avery that he scratched the turret interior. For and you know, it was a quote unquote rush job, and he's like, oh yeah, you know, if I spent more time on it, blah 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 blah. Of course, it wins best armor, and rightfully so, because it is amazing. He's an amazing modeler, and his displays are always, you know, the way he displays his models is very classy, because he's a woodworker as a second hobbyist. So his displays are always fantastic. But yeah, it was really fun. I forgot to mention my own models. I didn't bring any armor. This is the first time since I've been going to shows I've never brought an armor piece, mainly because I didn't have anything new or interesting to bring. So I just chose not to. I brought a handful of figures, and I brought some sci-fi stuff. Two of my figures, I brought six entrants, six things in six different categories. Two of my figure categories, I placed, I think I got a first and a second. So I was happy about that. Little French sailor, that little guy. Doesn't really place that often. I've taken him to quite a few IPMS shows, and I think it's the first time he's ever placed. He got first, and then Dante that I just finished, Dante got second. I was happy about that. The winner of the category that Dante was in, I met him, and now I feel like an idiot because I don't remember his name. He has a podcast called Listening to Paint Dry. They focus on miniature painting. He's a member of the Washington Figure Club, and him and I got a chance to talk a lot. Really good guy. He did a Rey Skywalker, which I hate saying Rey Skywalker. I'll just call her Rey because that's what her name should be, because she's not a Skywalker. But he did a figure of her like with a little desert scene, like with like the backdrop, which I love on figures, of her in the desert with a lightsaber. It's really, really well done. I looked at it and I forgot to take a picture of it because it was cool. I think Jackson got a picture of it. And then I brought my Y-Wing that I finished last year for flying. Sci-fi vehicles flying, which of course they split into Star Trek and Star Wars and everything else. And then I brought the Pack Croat that I finished. Both of those got first. And then for whatever reason, the Y-Wing won best space in sci-fi, which I don't understand why, because I like it. I think I did a good job, but I don't think it was the best thing on there. But for whatever reason, those dudes love that. Because when I went to go accept the award, the guy's like, "Oh man, that was really good stuff. That's really good." I'm like, "Oh cool, yeah." I built that like 10 years ago and just painted it like 6 months, not even like 4 months ago.
It was good. It's really good, but you know, and well deserved. That's awesome. Well,
thank you. I was honestly shocked. I was not expecting that at all. I didn't even expect it to win in its category because there was some good Star Wars stuff there. I think someone had the studio scale tie. I can't remember who makes that. Is that AMT?
Yeah.
Great kid. I want one so bad. That was there. I'm like, that's obviously going to win. Say what you want about IPMS. They love the big stuff. And it was big and it was well done. I don't even think it placed. But I liked it. I thought it was awesome. And there was a couple really good Star Trek ships too. I don't think any of those placed. I think it was all Star Wars. Two Y-Wings, one of them was mine, and another one. And then maybe that big TIE fighter did place. But so there's a fair, like I said, there's a lot of science fiction and Gundam type stuff there. There was like 8 Machine and Krieger entries in the sci-fi ground vehicles, which was pretty cool. I think most of them placed. I think all the stuff that placed was Machine and Krieger because I had one. And then there was 2 others. I think Mark 44 placed and might have been another Mark 44 that placed because they were good. That show is very competitive as far as skill or, you know, quality goes. It is not easy to place there in a lot, especially the aircraft categories, unless you're one of the geeks, then it's, you know, like riding a bike, I guess.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. And, I mean, all these shows are incredible. I love kind of getting back into show season and getting to go to these events. Hopefully, a bunch of our listeners, made it out to the events. It sounds like they did. We saw a few of them as well. But yeah, if the all these upcoming shows, if there's one in your area, go support it. You know, bring your work, share it with other people. You know, jump in there, have a good time, and you know, just that's what the hobby's all about. It's a good time to come together and collaborate and get new inspiration.
Yeah, and we have 2 coming up where we will all be together. That's Commies Fest, March 23rd in Denver, Colorado. And then the big one where I think a lot of people are getting together is the April 12th weekend, AMPS in South Bend, Indiana. So certainly those 2 will be a lot of fun. And there's plenty more in between and afterwards too.
Yep. To all of our listeners out there, hope to see you at a show really soon.
We're going to move on to models in the Plastic Posse group that we like. So I am going to start off with Scott. What do you think, Scott? What's your choice?
Yeah, so I was going through the group, and what caught my eye this time around was our buddy Jesse Naughton. He's done a Gecko Bedford truck that he's built for the Operation Overlord group build, and he's kind of put it on a little vignette with some ruins and some debris, and really like it. I like the overall the color palette. You know, there's a good blending of dust and everything, and he's done Mickey Mouse camo, which always is something that I really enjoy. And so great job by Jesse. I really like, he's got one of the concrete and stone brick walls there. He's got, has a kind of like a light fixture with electrical wires dangling, and you know, there's some birds and things on there as well. So I just really like it. I think the pieces more and more that I've been drawn to always seem to involve some kind of presentation and basing. And I think Jesse's really kind of pulled it off in this piece. So yeah, that's what's kind of caught my eye.
Yeah, it was really nice. I like the layers he did and everything. Jensen, how about you?
Yeah, for me, it was John Gray's Panzer III with Tropentan camouflage. It's just I always say this about people's builds, but the build's really clean. It's really nicely built, which I always think adds a lot to its finish if the build's good. The camouflage is really nice. That's a camouflage I've noticed a lot of people kind of struggle with because it's 2 different types of yellows that are kind of very subtly different from each other, but then obvious enough to stand out from each other. So that's been really well painted. It's soft freehand, so they kind of blend nicely into each other. The dust effects are really nice on it. I just really like how it's weathered. I think John did a really nice job with it. And it's a Panzer III. Everyone loves a Panzer III.
Yeah, it does. It looks really good. I like the camo too. That's a hard, hard camo to get right. You don't see it very often, but when they do it right, it looks really good. And John did a great job.
Yeah, the Tropen scheme is very low contrast. The thing that I noticed about John's work at the Model Mania show, he brought several of his pieces and, you know, especially in person, he's really good at doing a subtle presentation of the paint. His airbrush work and everything is really, I think it's really pleasing to the eye. It isn't overly stark, and it's fun to look at his work. He's really good at what he does.
Yeah, the Stug he had there was with the one with the winter camouflage was really nice. That was very, very well done.
My all favorite of his was the Tiger.
And I liked his T-34, so yeah, we all kind of like different things. So
yeah, JB, what about you?
I got to go with Dan Chalk's Firefly. I might be a little biased because I sent it to him, but he's doing a really nice job working on it for the Overlord group build. He's made a lot of great progress. It's almost ready for paint, and he's got a few little fixes on it. I appreciate, you know, when we look at, you know, feedback. I hate that word. But what's great about the Plastic Posse group, I think, was, you know, he received some really good feedback, especially sorry, Dan, to put you on the spot, but one of the light guards was turned upside down. Somebody called it out and he was able to fix it before he got too long in the finishing process. But I'm just shouting out the build because I love the Firefly, one of my favorite Sherman variants. And then also I love what he's done with the stowage, not only on the rear of the vehicle, but also on the front. So major shout out to Dan. Really looking forward to seeing it painted.
Yeah, it's really looking good. Doug, how about you?
Okay. How about Scott Samo? I known him for a few years now. I still don't know if it's Samo or Samo. From the Model Geeks, he finally finished his Revell 48 scale EA-6A, the Electric Intruder. Man, it's beautiful. I love that airplane. It's not at all ugly, like a lot of people like to say. And he's done just an amazing job on it. The finish is incredible. The details in the cockpit are incredible. He's only added a couple things. The RBF tags and the overhead console is all that he added to this kit. Otherwise, it's out of the box and it's a stunner.
No, it's really good. He does such beautiful work.
Yeah, that's pretty typical of his work.
Those guys are really the master of taking, you know, older kits and really, really making good looking, very, very modern day presentations that are worthy of anything else on the table. You know, Scott's really nailed it. I know it took him a long time to finish it. He had some issues that you would expect with a kit of that vintage, but his airbrush work is always the rock star, you know, of his builds. And he, you know, this one definitely doesn't disappoint. Great job.
Yeah, the color alone on that aircraft is just, I could sit there and stare at the color of that thing for hours. It's just beautiful. Good job. And myself, I'm going with, came from pointofview.hg. It's a 1957 Chevy Bel Air dually pickup conversion in 125th scale. It's a little bit different. They took the front of a Chevy Bel Air, the front part of it, and then they took a dually truck and converted it, made it a little like a ranch truck or something to that effect. It's beat up. It's got beautiful paint on it. It's got a blue and yellow paint on it, but it's all chipped up and looks old. The dually on the back is lifted like it would be in real life. It looks really, it's just different and fun. And I found that very enjoyable. Stuff like that is I like seeing that odd stuff like that every once in a while. Not once in a while, all the time, but it just makes it fun. And it's just a really cool looking kit.
Well, let's take a look at a bunch of these model shows and events we have here. Let's start with KC Con 2024, which will be held March 9th at the First Church of the Nazarene in Kansas City. You can find details over at ipmsgreatplains.org, or you can reach out on Facebook to Stuart Malone. On March 16th and 17th, we have Scala 2024, the Norwegian National Show and Competition. It's being held at the National Air Force Museum. The venue is a short drive north of Oslo and an even shorter trip from the international airport if you're traveling there for the show. The theme special category this year is going to be Finnish subjects.
What's the name of that museum?
I'm going to pass so that we keep our Norwegian listeners with us. But anyways, IPMS of Central Connecticut's annual swap meet and build day is going to be Saturday, March 16th. It's going to be held at the Buckingham Congregational Church in Glastonbury, Connecticut. They're going to be selling models and having a build day if anybody wants to participate. All modeling genres are welcome. If you want to sell models, then you can buy a table for $10. Drinks and refreshments will be available. And you can contact Zach Pease on Facebook for more details. The RightCon's Made in Ohio show will be held March 23rd and 24th at the University of Dayton. Doors will open both days at 9 a.m. and more details can be found at ipmsdayton.com.
HeritageCon 15 will be held at Canadian Warplanes Heritage Museum on Sunday, March 24th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. More details at IPMS Hamilton Canada Warplane Heritage Modelers Club Facebook page. Commies Fest 2024 Egg Planes and Jibs will be held Saturday, March 23rd at 9 a.m. at the Wings Over the Rockies Exploration of Flight Center. The BuffCon 39 model show, scale model show, will be held Sunday, April 7th at the Knights Events Center in Buffalo, New York. Doors open at 9 a.m. and they will feature a bunch of new categories for juniors and also categories for Gundam and Gunpla and Warhammer. You can contact Jeff Keenan for more details at IPMSNiagaraFrontier.com. AMPS 2024 International Convention will be held April 11th through the 13th at Center City, North Bend, Indiana. Details at AMPS/armor.org.
The Tulsa Modelers Forum and the Tulsa Miniature Motor Works are proud to present Route 66 Model Expo. The show will be Saturday, April 20th at the Park Church of Christ in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So this show will follow the lead from PaxCon of Gold, Silver, Bronze, so check with Casey Gray on Facebook for more details. Can-Man Challenge 2024, presented by IPMS Champion Valley and Mount Mansfield Scale Modelers, is being held on the 20th as well at Williston National Guard Armory in Williston, Vermont. So if you're in the Northeast, check it out at their Facebook page, the Mount Mansfield Scale Modelers. Next, we have the Houston Model Mania Show on May the 4th at the Stafford Center in Stafford, Texas. And the dual themes this year are May the 4th Be With You and Adversaries. They will have a great vendor area and an awesome facility of special Tsuburashi Mecha Award for Best Mecha. That's pretty cool. They also are implementing Gold, Silver, Bronze. What do you know? Another GSB. Outstanding. The Best of the West Show and Convention will be held on Saturday, May 18th. Most of us will be there, I believe, who are out on the Mountain Time and West Coast Time. We hope to make it over there at the Orleans Hotel and Casino. This show is put on by five different clubs in the area and runs from 9 to 5 p.m. Sounds like a lot of fun, and contact Jay Berger on Facebook for more details. Also on the 18th, you have the Silver Wings Club in Sacramento, SilverCon 2024. This year's theme is 1944. Doors open at 9 a.m., and the show will be at the Town and Country Lutheran Church in Sacramento, California. Please check out their Facebook page for more details, or contact Drew Savage on Facebook. We also have the 41st annual Smoky Mountain Model Con, which will be held on May the 25th at the Knoxville Catholic High School and Gymnasium in Knoxville, Tennessee. This show's theme is 46 to 45, and all deets can be found at KnoxvilleScaleModelers.com. Turn it over to Scott to finish us off with a special event.
You bet. Thanks, JB. On June 22nd in Salt Lake City, we will have a new hobby show. It's the first annual Rocky Mountain Expo. This will be an open format show and AMPS show kind of combined. It's being put on by a great consortium of different people. Some of them you know well. We have Barry from Small Subjects, as well as many other modelers over here. It's going to be really great. Something we're excited about. It is a gold, silver, bronze open competition, as well as, again, an AMPS competition for the armor folks. We'll announce more details soon. So, you know, just keep your ears here on the posse. If you're going to be close to the area on June 22nd, we'd love to see you here in Salt Lake City.
We'll definitely be there, Doug. Doug and Scott. I'll definitely cannot wait to be there, guys. It's going to be a fun show, and I'm really, really looking forward to it.
And Grant, last but definitely not least, yes. March 8th through the 10th, coming up very, very soon. Don't forget the 48 and 48 worldwide group build and fundraiser for Models for Heroes. The posse will be joining up with the Model Geeks on the North American leg of that. And I've been receiving boxes of donations from our sponsors, Tamiya USA, AK Interactive. value gear details, tank craft. We are getting two boxes today from Andy's hobby headquarters with some items that you will not want to miss. I'm not going to say what they are yet, but these auctions are going to be epic. So please make sure that's on your calendars. Grab a kit. Has to be unstarted. That's the only rule. We'll start Friday night at 7 p.m. and go till Sunday night at 7 p.m. We'll roll from the Eastern time zone to the Pacific time zone. Come help us, guys. We'll have an absolute blast. We'll be online pretty much the whole weekend. But the most important thing is we're going to be raising money to help people where we can use modeling to literally save people's lives. And there's nothing cooler than that.
All right. Let's go over to Doug for some feedback.
Okay. This is not going to be a lot. I've kind of been out of it, so I haven't collected a ton. But our feedback, we're going to start with Mark Doremus, who said, I had heard some level of disbelief when Grant talked about a modeler who used Everclear as an all-purpose modeling fluid. Despite several youthful incidents with the stuff, I think he was onto something. What is Everclear? It's basically 95% pure ethyl alcohol and a number of food-safe additives. It is drinkable, preferably with a mix of something sweet. I have used it to remove dried acrylic paints. What is denatured alcohol? Like Everclear, it is basically 95% pure ethyl alcohol, but with several noxious chemicals added to make it undrinkable. From a modeling perspective, I suspect the greatest difference between the two products is availability. Everclear can be easily found in most liquor stores, maybe even in some convenience stores, especially near college campuses. Don't ask me how I know. Denatured alcohol, on the other hand, is hard to come by. Hardware stores don't actually carry it anymore. They have a fuel version with petrochemicals in it. Commercial denatured alcohol can be found at paint stores as a window cleaner or online. It's also available in commercial or medical grades online. That's really good information. Thank you. And then I'm going to go to the voice of Bob. Another great show, guys. I was quite interested in your topic dealing with instructional videos. I am a visual learner and I like to be taught by example. Explain the process, show how you do it a couple of times, then show the results. Let me see how much paint you apply to your brush. Show me how much you wipe off for that old-fashioned dry brushing technique. Dazzle me with your technique. Finally, have a good voiceover. What's a good voiceover? Well, it's the voice of Bob. I mean, that's the best. Clear, concise, and interesting, he says. I'd give some examples, but I didn't find any. Thank you, Bob.
He hasn't been watching Night Shift lately, apparently. So,
or Rick.
That's what I've got for today. Thank you, guys. Thanks for giving us all your feedback and participating on our Facebook pages. And we really appreciate you all. And we'll move on.
All right. So we're going to move into our second discussion topic right now. So I kind of came up with this on the fly. I've been thinking about this at work a lot. But what do you think is the one thing in the hobby right now that is holding you back from getting to the next level in your modeling? I'm going to let Scott go first. So, Scott, what do you think is holding you back?
Well, I'm not Grant Mayberry with a paintbrush. That's not helpful. I think seriously, probably just discipline, you know, just making sure that I'm doing it every single day. You know, my output is the one thing that if I could change, I would aim at that. And so I think the discipline of, you know, we talked about in the past, maybe, you know, make sure you go every single day and go 15 minutes. You know, I don't want to be that regimented, but yet I think when you do find the time to go, even if you don't always feel 100% about it. And I think Jensen has been really eloquent about this. I think there's value in that. You know, it seems like TJ is one of, you know, just as busy as any of the rest of us. And he always seems to find time to crank stuff out. JB as well. You know, JB's super, super busy. And so, yeah, for me, I think it's just the discipline of, you know, getting things done and keeping things moving forward is the one thing that I think that I would work on and I think needs to be worked on the most.
Definitely. Definitely. I do see that. What about you, Doug?
I wouldn't want to say that comparing myself to others holds me back, because I don't think it does. But other people, when I see what people are capable of, and I know that I'm not hitting even close to those standards, it is a little bit depressing. Sometimes I think I see what I want to accomplish and I'm not sure how to reach it. I could do a better job of researching how to achieve some of these things. I don't know. Sometimes you just kind of want it to work for you. And if you have to take a few hours to go search YouTube and find those builders who are doing what you want to do and showing you how to do it, and you just aren't willing to give the time to it, that can really slow me down and hold me back. That's my biggest thing is I should be more willing to do more research to get myself to where I want to be, because there's plenty of people out there that are willing to show you if you're willing to look into it.
Yeah, I was going to say, besides research, you know, just Doug, just ask more. You know, we have a great resource here in the posse, and, you know, the people on this call, you know, that are really, really helpful. You know, I was able to watch Grant painting a dwarf up there at the Northwest Scale Modeler Show, and, you know, just sitting there and being able to watch him do what he was doing is really, really helpful and inspiring. And, you know, I've had the chance to work with JB being over at, you know, in Colorado, working with him. And, you know, for me, that's something you mentioned, kind of being intimidated by others. I don't have that issue. I'm always inspired by others. It's actually something I need to have. I think it's one of my favorite parts of the hobby, is seeing what other people do and what they come up with and how they get there. That really motivates me. It's probably the most important thing, like I said, for my motivation. John, what about you?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of what everybody's kind of said already. Certainly discipline is one thing. Talking earlier, jumping from project to project doesn't help, certainly from a finishing standpoint, but just time management too. I think that's the biggest thing, which is inherently linked to discipline. So when I get to the bench, just being really thoughtful about what I'm doing. And from my perspective, I improve by finishing. I see that as a kind of a goal of mine, and I feel a sense of completeness, which helps with a mental state. And then being able to move on and you know, fail quickly, essentially. And that was kind of with those little Terminators, just learning really quickly, busting those out, like within a week time frame, finishing those two figurines. So I found that really helpful. And during those sessions, it was very, 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 very focused time management. And with that, you know, I was thinking today, I've built a good amount, but I haven't published it all. And I find myself not going over and taking pictures during builds. And to be honest, it's actually really relaxing. So I'm not cutting up my time at the bench with taking some photographs. Now I need to, because I want to, you know, share some techniques and tutorials, but, you know, that's almost an afterthought now. I'm just getting back in the heart of scale modeling because time is limited.
Definitely. What about you, Jensen?
Kind of simple for me. Only thing holding back is myself. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not lacking on things to inspire me or resources on how to do anything. I hold myself back, not just in the hobby, kind of pretty much everything in life. Most of the time, because I'm quite anxious, doubt my own ability. Then I get thought paralysis, mm-hmm. which then prevents me doing anything because of the fear of messing said thing up. So I find myself doing nothing over the fear of doing it wrong. And the only way you actually do get better at stuff in life or improve is by making those mistakes in the first place. This is one of those, I know all this. Do I follow this advice? Do I listen to myself? Absolutely not. Do I listen to TJ telling me my work is good and I need to do more of it? Yeah, because TJ is scary and I don't want him to pick me up.
The enforcer. Yeah.
That's it. What holds me back is me and my discipline. It's not my ability, it's my discipline. I know I should start stuff and stick with it. And when it gets tough, still stick with it rather than be like, oh, here's a minor inconvenience. I'm not going to bother. It's like it doesn't work. Life doesn't work that way. Okay, you've got an inconvenience. Suck it up. Get on with it. Get past the inconvenience. This is all, like I say, this is all stuff I know. It's just I've got to actually put that into practice. And it's a change of attitude that's needed. Because without sounding in any way full of myself, I know my abilities there. I know what I can do. I know my work can be outstanding. The only person who's holding that back is me. There's no one else to blame. There's nothing else to blame. That's all me. And at the end of the day, it's the only person who's going to suffer from it is me. Yeah, and that's it. It's it's all about that headspace and changing it and just having the determination and drive to plow through when things get inconvenient or tough.
Yeah, that's a great point, Jensen. I mean, this is a hobby, right? We're supposed to be doing this because we enjoy it and everything, but yet I think we fear. I don't know what it is. Maybe when the hobby's not just easily fun, then you know, maybe it's just the world we live in. We have so much access to recreation at the tips of our fingers and information or whatever, but it's a hobby, you know, we're supposed to be having fun with it, and yet, you know, sometimes we get in our own heads. I know I do, but you know, your work is great. I'd love to see more of it. You know, just like I think all of us, I think I would say that about all of us, but it's just a matter of, you know, actually getting it done and moving forward. I love the 48 and 48 for this reason. I mean, you know, if you're going to finish a model in 48 hours, I think you have to go in with a mindset of, okay, it's not going to be perfect. If I hit this roadblock, what's plan B? And then you've got to immediately deal with it, and there's no procrastinating. I don't know if you feel that way, Jensen, but that's one of the things I really like about group builds that are very short, closed-ended builds like that.
Yeah, I do like the speed builds for that reason. It kind of removes... It's why I like the even group builds with like short deadlines. It's like you've got a time limit, so it removes the ability to overthink and try and plan too much. It's like, no, you've got to get it done in this time, so you've got to really efficiently use your time. Whereas with a lot of models, for example, it's like, well, I've no deadline, so I will literally take my entire life finishing it.
Yeah, that's definitely true, and I agree with you, Scott, too, and Jensen, about the 48-hour build is really good for me, that you're under timeline, and you don't have time to overthink, don't have time to... My biggest problem, and I'll tell you right now, and I've said it before, is I get too deep into it. I start thinking about... I do too much reference work on it. I get too deep into it, and then by the time I get time to ready to build, I'm done. I can't do it. I just don't want to. I know too much about it, and I can't do it. And I just overthink everything too much. And that's my biggest holdback, is that I think that's why I've moved to figures so much lately, especially fantasy, because I can't, it's fantasy. You can have a blue top, a green pants, and a yellow shirt. I don't care. There's no specifics to it. Like a lot of people said already, is that I just get lost in it. And when you get lost in it and you just lose the motivation, at least I do, I lose the motivation and I lose the drive to do it. Basically, when I build and paint, I have to turn my brain off, because if I start thinking about it too much, I'll just overthink it. And the next thing I know, I'll be like, well, that's not right. I got to go find a picture of it what it looks like really. And so, you know, that's my personal thing that's holding me back. The group has been fantastic for me. You guys have all been great. Everybody online has been great. Everybody is very, you know, positive, and you know, they're here to help you grow, you know. But, and I think part of growing though is understanding your failures or your problems or your hurdles in life, and then you're getting past those hurdles. So I'd raise this question with everybody out there. So what do you think is holding you back, and what are you trying to do to help you get past that? You know, that's the way I feel about it.
All right, so let's go head over to Jensen for a little bit of cross promotion.
Thank you, Grim. So the Plastic Posse is just one of several great scale modeling podcasts. If you're interested in more scale model content, you can head over to modelpodcasts.com, where you'll find links to many other great podcasts about our hobby. The Posse also recommends several excellent modeling blogs and vlogs, such as Stephen Lee's Sprue Pie with Frets, Chris Wallace's Model Airplane Maker, A Scale Canadian TV with Mr. Jim Bates, and David Brian Bridges' DB Scale Model Studio blog.
By the way, Jensen, what time is it?
Oh, Scott, I think it's time for merch. If you would like to rep the Posse, check out our awesome merch at our Triple P Spring page. You can find coffee mugs, t-shirts, jumpers, or even some of our world-famous Triple P lounge trousers. You can order all of your stylish Plastic Posse merch on the web at plasticpossepodcastcreatorspring.com or loungetrousers.com.
Before we wrap this episode, listeners, I also want to call out, if you are a Patreon member, you'll see a new benefit that's been added. So we are introducing the Scale Prospector. It will be a monthly magazine, e-magazine for that matter, that kind of captures you know, what we do in scale modeling. Right now, the first issue is out on Patreon. It features the first part of a diorama that I'm building. But what we've decided, since it's actually gotten an amazing response from the community, is we're going to expand it, and it's going to look like a scale modeling magazine. So you'll see multiple articles, you'll see references, you'll see show reports. Especially this issue upcoming, we're going to highlight the Atlanta show, and then also we'll highlight the Seattle show. And then also, you know, I'm saying a lot of alsos because there's just a lot of content in it. And you'll see builds from myself and TJ in the next one, and then maybe some other people as well. And we hope to highlight some of our listeners. So stay tuned for that. That'll be on the Patreon page. So if you're interested, want to learn more, please feel free to stop by Patreon to check it out.
All right. Thanks for riding along with us on episode 88 of the Plastic Posse. We appreciate your support as well as your support of our awesome Patreons. We also want to thank Tankcraft, Tamaya USA, AK Interactive for their support of what we do. And remember, the Plastic Posse is available to you on YouTube also. We won't return in 2 weeks like normal due to the 48 and 48 group build event, but we will be back in normal after that for more fun and great discussions about scale modeling. Do you have feedback, suggestions, ideas, or just want to drop a line, send your feedback to us via email at plasticpossepodcast@gmail.com. And yeehaw!
One of the ways that you can help to support the Plastic Posse is to become a Plastic Posse Outrider. If you would like to become an Outrider, well, it's pretty easy. Just go to our Patreon page. It's patreon.com/Plastic Posse Podcast and set up a recurring donation there. These contributions help offset the cost of bringing you the Triple P. There are three different tiers of support, and they start at just $1 a month. There are also some great benefits to being an Outrider, like early access to podcasts, premium access to the host, the chance to appear in a podcast, and exclusive Triple P content and social media events at shows, including the Scale Prospector that John just spoke to. Thanks to all the new Outriders who have joined in the last few weeks, and we hope that you're all liking the content, and especially the first issue of the Scale Prospector.
Let's recognize our amazing deputy marshals. These guys step up and help the posse do what we do, and we sincerely thank them for their support. Black Hat Scale Models, Ben Hardaway, Craig Jarbo, Adam Jackson, Red Beach One Studios, James Morando, Casey Gray, Mike Norris, Stephen Rodwell, Rick Cooper, Tim Gidcomb, Dan Newman, Robert Blocker, Tyler Moore, Derek Post, Craig Flynn, Brian Kreiner, Scale Model Craft, Ken Childress, Nick Butta, Drew Gardner, Scott Hall, Frank Perrone, The Voice of Bob, Jeremy Diamond, Ryan Smith, Terry Wilkinson, Chris Lovewell, Andrew Callis, Ethan Idenmill, Bruce the Model Noob, Steve Baker, Erica Deglish, Joe Porsche, Patrick Brown, Steve Schaefer, Jay Kidd, Brandon Gentry, Robert Klein, Mark Ewing, Ted Kawahara, Toadman, Model Doc, Doug Reed, Greg James, Les Workala, John Everett, Josh Buck, Thomas Bannock, Mark Bradley, Zach Pease, Joel Munson, Eric Brubaker, Jeremy Moore, DB Scale Model Studio, Matt Johnson, Jeremy Elliott, Mike Talley, Previous Seat, Mediocre Middle-Aged Modeler, Dan Knoffel, and J.C. Osborne.
and before we move on, we just want to say to Doug Reed, Doug, we hope you're feeling better. We miss you in Seattle, and we hope to catch up with you soon, buddy, but feel better.
Let's also recognize our excellent posse foremen. These foremen are Outriders who give our deputy marshals a hand. Gil, Mike, Michael, Steve, Winston, Scott, Emery, The Krieger, Keith, William, Tim, Jeff, Eddie, Ross, George, Gary, Workup Models, Ross, Eric, Lynn, Cliff, Eric, Papa Steve, MB Models, JV, Damien, Keenan, Cody, Tim, Nukeman Mike, Greg Ash, Irish Pat, sorry, Paul, what's the deal with iBones Models? Mr. Grizz, Baxton, MAK Models, Chris, Lee, and Jamie. And of course, our Posse Outriders. Lastly, if you would please consider posting a review of the Triple P on your podcast platform, each 5-star review helps other modelers find the Plastic Posse.